Welcome to the High Velocity Radio Show. High Velocity Radio is brought to you by PSI Digital Media Experts, the market leader in delivering digital media services. From manufacturing millions of CDs and DVDs to turnkey e-commerce solutions and streaming high-definition video over their worldwide content distribution network, PSI has the solutions to meet your needs. Find PSI at psidiscs.com, psidiscs.com. The High Velocity Radio Show is where we celebrate innovative professionals producing better results in less time. Produced and directed by Lee Cantor and brought to you live from Radio X Studio in Atlanta, Georgia. Now here are your hosts, Todd Schnick and Stone Payton.
Welcome to the High Velocity Radio Show. This is your host, Stone Payton, and joining me in the studio this morning is our producer, Lee Cantor, and my good buddy and co-host, Todd Schnick. Good morning, Todd. What's going on, baby?
Not much, Stone. How are you this morning?
I am doing well. Hey, I brought you a post-it note this morning.
Post-it note?
Yeah, well, over the weekend, I went and saw the Cobb Symphony Orchestra Jazz at the newly renovated Strand Theater on the Square, and found out that they're having a 5K run. It's called the Noteworthy 5K Walk Run. So I thought I'd get you signed up.
Yeah, you know, now that I've finally recovered from my my near-fatal cold, I'm getting back into the running thing, and I think I've already signed up for that event.
Oh, are you?
Is that
okay.
The one through Todd Youngblood's
through Todd?
Yeah. Yep. No, he's already made me aware of it, and I've actually signed up.
So you're getting the T-shirt and the whole thing. Well, I'm signing up, too, but what I love about this run, you can pay $25 or something and do the run, or you can pay $20. You still get the T-shirt, and you don't even have to show up.
That's just your kind of exercise.
Yeah,
time.
And so there's no embarrassment factor or anything. It's just built right into the system.
You're not even going to walk it? It's only 3 miles.
I'll come and walk it with you. It's at Marietta High School.
I'm not going to walk it. I'm running.
You're really going to run it?
Yeah, yeah.
All right.
It's only 3 miles.
All right, well, it's February 20th, 2010, starts at 8:30 a.m., and it benefits the Cobb Symphony Orchestra. We had a great time. If you haven't been to the Strand since it's been renovated.
I have not. How's it look?
It's absolutely gorgeous. And listening to these guys play jazz. I know you're into jazz. I'm not really a jazz aficionado, but boy, did we have a great time, and they were terrific.
Well, for the audience that doesn't know, it's the old theater on the Marietta Square.
Yes, right there on the square.
And how old is it? I mean, it dates from the 30s, 40s,
it looks like it was built in like the 20s, 30s, yeah. Something like that. I honestly don't know. I have a good friend that's pretty well connected to the Strand family, so I'll find out.
Yeah, well, they've been trying to get that redone and renovated for quite some time. I'm looking forward to getting a chance to checking it out.
But we want to support the our buddy Youngblood and the Cobb Symphony Orchestra any way we can, and we want to support the good folks at the Strand because they're doing some neat work. I did find out that there's a website you can go to, and I should have brought it with me, but we'll have that next time for you as well. But there, apparently, if you go on the website, you can sign up to attend some special events at the Strand where you can sit up in the balcony and watch different events going on in the square. So we'll do a little homework. It's all part of our renewed effort at the High Velocity Camp to get more invested in the community. And, in fact, we've started a new section on the blog called Making a Difference. And so we'll have some of this stuff posted. And we've got your outfit that you serve on the board, Furniture Bank of Metro Atlanta. We've got the Cherish,
yeah.
The
Cherish
Future
is
event posted.
Is coming later this month or later in February. It's a fundraiser to raise money to provide furniture for families who have just come out of homelessness and or typically women who have escaped domestic violence. And so they get a fresh start. And spend every last nickel just getting a roof over their head, but then they don't have any furniture for the kids. And so we help them by providing beds and kitchen tables so the family can eat together. And the event itself is a lot of fun. Vern Yip, who you're familiar with from HGTV, will be our honorary host.
I like Vern. He's shorter than I am.
Yeah. He's the one.
He's my buddy.
Yeah. There's only two people shorter than you on the earth, and he's one of them. So, But that'd be a great event.
Yeah, and that's the 27th
yes.
of February,
yes.
I think. And I don't know, we're going to have a high velocity table or at least a bunch
of. We will
of
probably have a high velocity table, and there is information about that event on our website. If you go to that Make a Difference page, there is some details of the event there. So
that's what Todd and I do. You know, we have the radio show, and we go around and we video authors and chefs and hang out at all these cool events. I had to get my own tux last year.
We don't actually work, so.
Well, no. No point in doing that.
No.
Well, tell us about the show today. This is the second week in a row where I've had absolutely nothing to do with booking the guest. Who'd you bring with you this morning?
Which is why they've been better shows.
Yeah, they really have been good shows.
So, well, I assure you today's promises to be an awful lot of fun. Our first guest is the VP of e-business and interactive marketing for Newell Rubbermaid. Welcome, Bert DeMars.
Oh, thanks for having me.
So how long have you been with the organization, and tell us a little bit about what you do for them.
2 years and 7 months, and I'm actually responsible for pretty much all the websites and the web platform, also help all the brands. We have many brands. We have almost 30 brands and 13 global business units, and help them with their web properties, with their social media marketing activities, and their interactive marketing activities. So I'm in kind of a unique role because I'm in corporate, so I work across all the brands, so I get to see all the activities and work with all of them, whereas then each brand, then they focus on what they do, right, whether it's Sharpie or Graco or Irwin Tools. So,
well, it sounds like a wicked cool job. I mean, I saw some collateral material that you've put together where I wish I had it with me, where you open it up and it has a listing of all the brands under the corporate umbrella, and like a little flow chart about which ones have a Facebook page, which ones have a Twitter page, and it's pretty, and that's what you do, is you manage those and monitor them and or task that out to a staff that kind of pays attention to those sites.
Right, and kind of the way it works is, and people think, well, we're a big Fortune 500, we must have tons of people doing this, and actually it's very small. Each brand has typically 1 to 2 people who are actively involved with interactive marketing and social media, and then a lot of other volunteers who step up and will give a percentage of their time. And then the way that that pamphlet that we made, we actually made that for the Blogwell event we held in November.
Okay.
And so we had 250 attendees from 70 different corporations. Just wanted to show them kind of what the activities we were up to, and everyone always asked what the pink F was on the little pamphlet, and that was for Flickr. And surprisingly enough, I know people kind of forget about Flickr, but actually that was one of the first success stories for us with Graco Baby was on the Flickr site. And we actually got some rave reviews about the photos we were taking, and it was humanizing the brand and humanizing our employees. And so lots of photos of our employees with families, and of course some Graco products would slip in there.
Oh, so it was Graco?
Yeah, that was Graco Baby.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, that makes sense. So it's showing the children?
Yes.
Oh, okay. Yeah, Flickr is one of those tools that I actually have an account, and I do a lot of things, and I share my photographs on that, and I'm amazed at the amount of downloads and people that view that stuff. If you're doing it right and you tag the photos with the right keywords, they can be found, and I do work for Fuego Mundo, and a lot of their photographs have been viewed a lot, so it's an amazing tool.
Well, and I think as long as you reference it in all the different places where you're active, right? And Graco's active on Twitter, and they're active on Facebook, and we have a blog, and of course the website. And so wherever we're active, as long as we're kind of pointing at all these different properties and these different things that we're doing, it's leveraging each one for who it works best for. And that's kind of one of the key learnings is that you just never know what's going to resonate with your audience. I mean, some audiences really like Twitter and some don't. Some really like forums. They prefer something more traditional, and some really prefer Facebook. And it just sort of depends. And for each brand, it's a little bit different.
For instance, there's a lot of mommy bloggers out there. And I imagine that there's probably some interaction with them in terms of the Graco.
Yeah, just a little.
Yeah.
there's actually where we started with Graco. Graco started, and this is, this is going back 2.5 years. Graco started by actually going out and talking, face to face in real life, as they like to say, IRL, talking to the moms and just saying, what would you, before we even got out there, what would you like us to do? I mean, if you were going to do this, how would you want us to do it? And then the other big question is what would you not want us to do? Which is basically, don't coupon me into the ground. Don't pound me with product. I mean, if I want to find out a product, I'll go to the website. You got great information there, and I got tons of information from the retail sites. But I want to find out about Graco, and I want to find out about the people at Graco. And that was really what came through. And that was 2.5 years ago, and so we've done that now. We've successfully humanized the brand, right? And we've put a face on the brand. Lindsay Labresco was the first person to do that. Kelly Volker's doing it now. And the next step is, okay, how do we extend it, right? How do we extend that into, if you think about it, social media eventually at some point has to have some sort of ROI. And the ROI may be brand building. It may be brand awareness. but Graco has that pretty well under control. The next step is, how do you make sure that when the mom gets into the big box store, whether it's Babies R Us, Target, Walmart, or if they're buying online, that they prefer us and they select us? And so we're trying to figure out, where does social media fit in all of those different places? And that's really what we're working on now.
Well, I really like that term. I think every organization should have an IRL strategy. You know, we talk a lot about social media strategy. How about an IRL strategy, an in-real-life strategy?
Absolutely.
You mentioned a term earlier in the conversation, interactive marketing. Mm-hmm. I hear that a lot. I hear Todd talk about it a lot. But what does that really mean to you, interactive marketing?
So it's not just push marketing, right? It's not just mass media marketing. It's actually the point of you're starting a connection with the consumer, the customer. So they're actually doing activities based on what you're doing online. And that's where interactive is. So I do something online. Maybe I am doing search marketing. Maybe that's a little more mass. But then I'm drawing them into a website, or I'm drawing them into a blog, or I'm drawing them into Twitter. I'm trying to draw them in somewhere where we'll have some form of an interaction. Maybe the interaction is very light, right? Maybe it's just they just want to go there and they want to read about stuff, which the vast majority of all consumers do. They don't want to necessarily communicate with you. They just want to read. They want to understand. They want to learn. They want to read other people's reviews. And then there's sort of higher levels of consumer interactivity where consumers are actually doing product reviews and they're making comments and they're including things in their blogs or they're Twittering about something. So that's kind of where the interaction keeps jumping up. And I know we use this term social media, and social media is really the wrong term. It's really social networking or just social in general. It's word of mouth at a digital level, and that's kind of the way we see it. Social media is kind of weird because that sounds about media. And media is but one part of social interaction. So and in real life, I think, is really important. And that's where Graco was very strong. And when Rubbermaid came along next, they've been doing the same thing. But they do it with professional organizers and some do-it-yourself homeowners. So it's meeting the people in real life really helps you. And it helps you a lot later on because you're building up a base, not only of fans, but of people you have a relationship with that maybe someday will save you.
Well, I was a little surprised to learn that Newell Rubbermaid had a grown man in charge of this effort. And here's what I mean by that. By everything that I've been reading, and it looks to me like the traditional approach for a lot of organizations is to get someone right out of college, you know, hire an intern. And then I remember the guy that you follow so much, the Chris Brogan guy, I remember hearing him in a speech say, no, you don't want a $25,000 a year intern doing this. You want a $100,000 a year professional. So what prompted the organization to make that kind of investment in a professional?
So remember, this is social networking, social media at our company is but one part of anyone's job. No one does this 100%. As much as I've been told over and over, you should have people doing this 100%. Well, we don't. And for good reason, and partly because we run a little bit lean, but partly because there are other roles where these people add a lot of value. So like Kelly Volker at Graco, she doesn't do just social media. She does, you know, PR. She does communications. And she does crisis communications, which may be the most critical part of her job, especially with baby products. And then if I look at Jim Dietzel at Rubbermaid, he's doing e-marketing. He's doing, you know, he's doing the website. He's doing social media marketing. He's writing on the blog. I mean, he's doing a whole bunch of different things. So, and then if you look at Sharpie Susan, she's the head of communications, not only for Sharpie.
Sharpie Susan.
Oh, you haven't met Sharpie haven't, Susan?
Oh, Sharpie yeah. Susan's awesome.
Oh, she's cool. Oh, yeah.
but Sharpie Susan not only does that, and Susan Wassel, she also does the communications for Prismacolor, and she does it for Expo Markers. And so she's doing multiple brands. So she's not supporting just one brand, but multiples. And she doesn't do the social media for the other two brands. She just does it for Sharpie. So it's just a part of, you know, everyone's a part of their job. But it goes back to what you were saying about youth versus experience. And what I find is that, I can bring in someone fresh out of college. And, yeah, they know this stuff. I mean, they know the tools cold. They use them on a daily, hourly basis, right? Their thumbs are magic when it comes to text messaging, where mine are just thumbs. But when it comes to actually communicating as a brand or a company, it's very different. Now, you can be fun, and we're all about being fun, because if you're not fun, who cares, right? No one wants to listen to you anyway. But there is a way to respond. There's a way to, you know, give attribution. There's a way to, you know, make sure you're linking to things. And I can remember when we had some interns early last summer, and we put them on Twitter and we put them on the blog, and they would communicate out like they were communicating with their friends. Well, that's all well and good, but these aren't your friends. These are your consumers and customers. And maybe they'll become your friends, but you've got to give them information. You've got to lead them somewhere. And they were leading. They were saying things like, "Isn't Sharpie cool?" Well, yeah, Sharpie's really cool, but you know, there's more to it than that. And let's talk about. And now we actually have one who's who converted from intern to full time, and she is great at this. She knows, she points them in the right direction. She's giving attribution to where the content came from, you know, giving people what they need. And so that's a big change, and it's something that I don't think you can learn just in school. I think it's something you learn through experience.
A very serious question about Chris Brogan, though. Does it bother you that he refers to your stainless steel Sharpies as probes?
They are not probes. Stainless steel Sharpies are cool. In fact, they're kind of hard to come by right now.
You know
now.
What? I'm going to disagree with you. I was at my Office Depot that's in East Cobb, and there was a whole stack of them, and I was thrilled. I bought a bunch of them.
That's good. It took them a while to get there because I remember when we first launched them, and for the first 60 days, first 60 or 90 days, the only place you could find them was Amazon.com. And I remember that. And we actually did a little social media experiment around it. Just Susan and I just were kind of Twittering and LinkedIn. We used every different tool we could find just to try and just expose that it was there on Amazon. It sold out the first night. It was just funny. And it wasn't like there was a lot of inventory. This wasn't like we sold thousands. But it was a test to see, could social media by itself actually do a little push? And we did it. And because there was no other media around it. There was no other marketing effort around it when it first launched. And Amazon was just sort of, we have it. It's available. That was it. And so we did this, and it really pumped it up. It went up high in the Office products rankings. So I think there is a place. And that was because we'd built up over time a large group of people who were interested in following Sharpie Susan or myself or some other people at Newell Rubbermaid.
Now, I'm asked every day by organizations large and small, all right, what's the real purpose? Or give me a reason why I need to invest energy in something like social media. And you mentioned the word crisis communications a few minutes ago. And in our pre-show chat, we were talking about some things, and you were sharing quite an adventure that the organization was going through last week in terms of a recall and all that. Would you mind telling them about that story and how you and your team in integrating with other people in the organization kind of dealt with that?
Sure. So we did. We had a recall last week that was highly visible. In fact, it was on the Today Show. It was one of their opening segments, so they made it as visible as anything, and it should be. We had about a million plus strollers that were impacted by a recall. There was something with the snap on the side where the carriage is, and if a child reached their hands back there, they could lose a finger or get a finger severely cut. And some children, a handful of children did. Out of, 1.5 million, their handful did. So there was a simple recall, and there was just a wraparound. It's like a little wrap that goes on it. And why I bring this up is, so when those recalls happen, the volume on the website goes up 100x. The moms are very anxious. And the other sad thing was for us was that, yes, this is injury, this injured babies, but we were also tied to a crib recall that had at least killed one child. And so when you tie the two together, everyone gets very anxious about these things. We had a choice, and a competitor of ours, I won't name the competitor, a few months earlier had made a choice to do the way they did, was they put out a press release, they made their website available, and then that was it. They decide not to communicate. We, on the other hand, we had built up this social media following. We had a lot of moms, tons of moms who were, engaged with us on our blog and on Twitter and all these places. So we decided through our crisis communication, not only was Kelly going to be responding to the press, she was also going to be responding to moms. And so she was reaching out to moms that she knew. We put a blog post up about this. We actually had to put up a backup web page because the website got so much volume it went down on that day. And so that was part of my job, was we were doing firefight just to get the hardware up. But at the end of the day, on Thursday, this is the day after, a Christian Science Monitor article came out talking about how helpful Kelly had been with several moms, and guiding them to the right place. And how anxious they were, and they were happy that someone was responding, and our customer service department was responding, and they were answering thousands of phone calls, and kind of combining that, that sort of build up over time of an effort, right, to build relationships with moms, and on the other hand, them being responsive during the time of crises together, came out with it's a lot better off than it could have been. I mean, it's horrible to have a recall, and it's horrible that babies were injured. But at the end of the day, we did everything we could to mitigate it. We also put up a YouTube video that any of the moms could go to so they could see how they could easily they get this little wrap thing, and it wraps around the clip, and then it's the problem solved. So, but that was it was a tough day, and it was a tough week because of that. And the volume was pretty high, and you know, and the press is not going to be kind to you when you have a recall like that. So you just have to deal with it. And she dealt with that too. At the same time, she was dealing with mom. So it was kind of a it was a good thing, and it was a good learning for us too. And it proved the point that during a crisis, if you have a long term, well established program in place where you're actually actively communicating with customers, you can do a lot of good.
Well, the key to that story isn't that when the bad news hit the world that you then got active on Twitter quickly and said, hey, everything's going to be okay, and here's how we do. That was different because you had taken the time to establish those relationships in advance.
Right.
Is where that magic really happened. And that's the key lesson to our listeners as to how to deal with that kind of situation. It's establishing those relationships in advance.
Right, and not giving up. During those times when you think it's not working or you think it's slow or it's not growing or, and don't get all tied into, well, why don't I have 10 million followers on Twitter or on Facebook?
Yeah.
Well, you may not, and Graco doesn't. And we really believe in organic growth. We believe that moms and dads will come to us if they want to. They may come to us and just read. They may not want to be a follower. They may not want to be a fan on Facebook. But they may come to the page and look and get information. And so we made sure information was available in all these places. And we also made sure that they knew that these places were there, right? And we've been there for, over 2 years now, so.
Well, the way that your organization, the way you conducted yourself last week, though, also just speaks volumes to the culture, the core values that must be held and very well espoused at that organization. Can you just say a little bit more about the culture there at Newell Rubbermaid?
Well, the culture is kind of interesting. So we have... We as a company were really, up until a couple of years ago, just a portfolio of brands, and each brand had their own culture, and corporate had its own culture, if it had a culture at all in reality. Now, though, that we've moved all the brands, many of the brands into one building, and we have three main campuses, a culture is growing, and it's really nice to see. In fact, one of the things that we didn't used to have was you couldn't cross from one brand to another, like from a career perspective.
Oh, really?
Well, one of our new directors of marketing at Goody just came over from Graco. That's brand new for us. It used to be if you did baby products, you couldn't sell Goody hair products or vice versa because you didn't know that space. Well, that's not necessarily true. The truth is a good marketer is a good marketer, and let's find the right place for them. And So that's kind of the change in the culture. Graco has always had a nurturing culture. They really have. And it's kind of amazing that if you go back a few years that people thought, and that was one of the reasons we got into social media, was that people thought Graco was a typical Fortune 500 business and that they didn't necessarily care. We had great products. We had great word of mouth, but we just weren't seen as, we were seen as kind of corporate. And so when we started the social media program, again, it was about humanizing the brand. Well, that humanizing the brand and showing that real people, real parents, with real concerns who have these same strollers, for example, as the recall, are involved with this. And we wouldn't put our kids in these things if we didn't think they were safe and of high quality. So I think that was kind of part of the message. And then Graco just, a lot of them are moms and dads too. And they feel the pain, right? They understand when parents are concerned. And so that's why reaching out and being, very active in this, last week in particular, was very important to them. And our VP of marketing, Andrea Freeman, and our GM, Kim Lefko, they're just outstanding executives, and they lead this effort, and they're very caring, and they're both moms too. In fact, Kim Lefko, when we started the social media program, was having her second child, so she became one of our top stories. Our VP of marketing,
I'll bet.
which was a big thing for the brand and for the moms because they go, oh, your VP of marketing is a mom, and she's having her second child, and oh, she cares, and she's, she's not just doing this just because, right? It's not about just bucks, right? It's about, she cares about moms, she cares about kids, so it's important.
Now, I think what you're doing at Newell is becoming more and more recognized as a model of how it should be done. And in fact, if I understand correctly, you do an awful lot of traveling and speaking at conferences. You just got back from one in Nashville.
Oh yes, I've been speaking a bit. It's kind of funny. Most of it's I try and stay local as much as possible because I try not to travel too much. But I did sort of this V thing where I hit Nashville for the Social Fresh conference, and then I came back for a day, and then because I actually had a a meeting with Graco, and then left the next day and went to Greensboro, North Carolina to do the With It conference, which is a women's leadership conference. And it was great to do both of those. It just was 1,200 miles in 3 days, and so I was kind of zonked.
It's tough being a rock star.
Well, you must be a really good speaker to get invited to do a women's leadership conference. That's pretty impressive.
Well, it was... It was more related to the fact that our Levelor brand, so this is the multi-brand kind of opens the door to this. Levelor brand, so the women's leadership was also a home furnishings, the group that I was speaking at. And Levelor is, you know, another one of our key brands. And so the Levelor team had asked me to go and to speak, so I did.
Cool.
So, all good.
So I guess we're getting close on time. So want to do a few things. One, first of all, if you could share with us how people can get in touch with you and learn more about what you do and how to reach out to you.
Oh, well, probably the easiest is on Twitter, and I'm at BWDumars, BWDumars on Twitter. That's probably the easiest way to get a hold of me. A lot of people find me there. My email is bert.dumars@newellco.com. NEWELLCO.com. So okay. Those are probably the two easiest ways to get a hold of me.
All right. Right. If you had to follow one brand on Twitter just to kind of see how it's done, what's the one you'd recommend?
One of our brands?
Yeah.
It depends where you are. I mean, the three that are the most active are Graco, Rubbermaid, and Sharpie. If you want the most fun, interesting, I mean, coolest stuff you will ever see in your life, follow Sharpie, because it is...
That's where I'm going when I get home.
It is amazing.
Sharpie.
It is amazing what is provided back. That was the craziest social media thing. We started that, and then we started getting content like you wouldn't believe. I mean, Lamborghinis that are customized with Sharpie pens. I mean, just, I always go back to that one, because that one amazes me to this day. But that one, if you want to see the most creative people, find some of the most creative people in the world, follow Sharpie Susan, because she'll point you to all of them. If you're really an organization, you know, into organizing your home and all that, Rubbermaid is a great one, and it is Rubbermaid on Twitter. And then and they're doing Twitter talks right now. They're doing all these Twitter talks, kind of having fun with that. And then if you're a new mom or dad, or you're going to be a new mom or dad, Graco Baby. Because we have lots about parenting. We point you to a lot of resources just all around the parenting, and then we hope maybe someday you'll buy some Graco products.
You can count on it. Well, Bert, before we let you go, we have a little tradition here on the High Velocity Radio Show. We like to ask each guest if they would to share a mistake that they've made at some point in their career, and really more importantly, what they feel like they learned from it. Could we get you to do that for us?
Yeah, so I'll go back in time. Actually, I did a startup once long ago, and the one thing I will always tell you, you never can have enough money in a startup. I did a startup back in 1999, and I did a little it was an e-commerce, and it was probably about 5 years too early. That was probably the other thing. But we had about $400,000, and we built out the website and got up and running, got to revenue, and then just started running out of cash because we were too early and didn't have enough to carry us through. And I would say that was the key learning, was make sure you have enough cash, and have enough cash. You're gonna have to last about 2 years, especially if you're doing some sort of an e-commerce or e-business. I think today it's a lot easier than it was back then, because back then you had to invest a lot of the hardware and the infrastructure, which we did. Today you can use things like Amazon's S3 and get yourself up and running fairly quickly and painlessly. But I still think you need a lot of cash to get you to home. So that was one of my key learnings.
Never run out of cash.
Well, no, make sure you have enough to get you to the point where you have enough revenue to survive. And that's more of that's if you're going to go. And I think that was more of the VC type, you know, startup involvement, that I was trying for at that time. But that was a few years ago. I think the market's changed quite a bit. You see a lot of kids, not just kids, but, you know, older people who are starting businesses now that they don't necessarily need as much cash as they used to.
But it's still wise to be realistic about what that number is.
Yeah, I heard a guy once, and he was because I went to University of Michigan and he did too, and he came and he spoke to us, and he goes, the one thing that we had the last 2 years. He said, 2 years is about right. If you can last 2 years without being profitable, you can make it. You have a shot at making it. If you can't, it's going to be a struggle.
Yeah.
And I saw the struggle firsthand.
They are kids. The guys that are running WordPress and Facebook and all those are 23 years old and are worth $1 zillion. It's sickening.
I find it inspiring.
Yes, I do too. Whatever.
Well, Bert, it has been an absolute delight having you on the show. Thanks so much for coming on. I hope you'll come back sometime and bring Sharpie Susan with you.
Oh, yeah. We'll have to get her on the phone. She's up in Oak Brook, but thanks for having me.
Yeah.
Oh, we'll have to have a Newell roundtable.
There you go.
Bring all those guys.
Just, oh, yeah, one from every brand.
Well, Kelly and Lorianne does Goody. They're right next door, so we could pop them over.
Yeah, that sounds terrific. Well, listen, can you hang out with us for a little while we visit with our next guest?
Sure, no problem.
Terrific. Well, who else did you bring with you, Todd?
Well, the last time I saw our next guest, she was all dressed up as a punk at the Punk ATL tweet-up last December. She is the chief IP strategist at the Hutter Group and is a recovering patent attorney. So welcome, Jackie Hutter.
Thank you very much.
So tell us what IP is and intellectual property. I don't know what that means. So tell our audience exactly what it is that you do.
Well, quite simply, it's everything that Bert just talked about. It's this brand. It's capturing and creating brand value. It's capturing that and actually making it a tangible asset. So in other words, making your intangibles tangible. Most people are familiar with intellectual property because of patents and trademarks and other things. But intellectual property is just one aspect of intangible assets. So why do we care about all this work that's done, for example, in the social media context? It's because it does something for the organization that pursues, you know, executes that strategy. So it's what folks fail to do most of the time. Actually, it's shocking how even the most sophisticated business people don't get why they're doing this. Is because it creates value for their organization. And there's no controversy today that the vast majority of corporate assets are in the form of intangibles. People can quibble about the amount, 70, 80, 90%. I actually think for most companies, above 90%. If you don't have inventory sitting in a warehouse somewhere, if you don't have real estate, you are intangible. And so, but it just doesn't exist because we say it exists. It only exists if we identify, capture, and protect it. Only then can we realize it. So I work with organizations, in the patent space and the IP space, the stuff that you get, but also more broadly in the intangible space, just to help you understand where the value lies in that regard. And as one striking example, when I was sitting here listening to Bert, and I'm thrilled, they're just doing some incredible, incredible things, is people say, well, how do I value this? How do I know why I'm doing this? Well, the easy thing to do is to say, how much less would your organization be worth? How much less would your brand be worth if you weren't doing this? How much value would you have lost last week in your overall brand if you had not gone through and done the strong forward-thinking strategy that you did to deal with the crisis last week? You would have lost incredible value in the brand, way more so than you did. And so if you subtract out that difference, that's the value that Bert's creating every day. And he should go into his weekly or monthly meetings saying, I created this much value for my organization this month. And it's not that hard. You just have to think about it.
So identify a scenario by which an organization has gotten themselves into a situation where they need to call Jackie Hutter. What prompts them to need you?
Well, typically folks call me because they're disappointed with the patent process. But that's most likely too late. What I tell, because there's a problem, and they've probably filed a patent that's too narrow or doesn't cover their invention or something bad has happened. So they realize, oh, I'm doing something wrong, crisis control. Well, in reality, where somebody like me, and there's very few of me, quite honestly, come in, is actually before you even start talking about value at all, before you go talk to an attorney, before you go talk to a social media strategist, anything. Because what I say to folks is that, you know, where do you want to be in 3 years? And if you have an exit strategy, then you need to develop intangible assets that help you create and maximize that and realize that exit opportunity. So I can help folks after they've filed a patent and maybe disappointed or maybe concerned, and help fix that, help build a broader ecosystem, broader value proposition. But I love to talk to entrepreneurs before they've even put the stake in the ground for everything.
So that's who you target, though, is entrepreneurs.
Anybody with an exit strategy.
Okay.
And for as one example, if for my clients, I tell them if they're in competition with the big boys, or they're seeking to exit into the big boys. The big boys have armies of me. I know a lot of people at the, Rubbermaid. They're great folks. They're very smart folks, and they've got very, very deep pockets. So if you want to, if you want to play with them, you've got to be them. And so I can provide those same types of counseling and opportunity analysis that that the folks that you want to be or be with also get.
My instincts are that somebody that's involved in the kind of work that you are, you probably run into some pretty similar patterns. Like you walk in and you say, yep, seen this before. What are some patterns that you run into, or some common mistakes that you witness over and over again?
A great example is something that recently counseled somebody on. For confidentiality reasons, I can't go into the details, unfortunately. But these are folks that have a new business model for searching. And it is going to – imagine if travel agents were still done by books and paper, okay? This is what their industry is. And they're actually in the books and paper industry. But they've planned on putting themselves into business, out of business, I should say. And so they have been working on a search database, search model, search algorithm for several years. And they're about to launch. And so they thought, well, gee, the VC folks tell us we need to get a patent. And so I was called in by their business counsel to see whether or not they needed a patent or not. And I knew immediately they shouldn't get a patent. Bottom line is, patents on business models, patents on search algorithms, the people who get paid lots of money for filing these patent applications will disagree with me, but in large part, those are not patentable. We're going to be hearing some stuff about from the Supreme Court in a couple of months that's going to be that this stuff is only patentable under very limited circumstances. But also, even if it was patentable, when you're filing a patent application on a business model, on a search algorithm, on some kind of business thingy, you have to open the kimono, as we say. You have to show everybody what you're doing. Mm-hmm. Well, then what happens is that everybody knows what you're doing, but you're not going to be able to be, as we say, police it. You're not going to know whether or not they're using the exact same method or process that you've disclosed. And also, quite honestly, if they're doing it in Bulgaria, if they're doing it in India, you're not going to be able to do anything about it. So in reality, folks in that sphere should not be filing patent applications. So I was able to tell this client, I said, no, don't file a patent. I don't care what the VCs say. Not filing a patent application is a valid patent strategy as long as you've made the decision for articulatable business reasons, and you can talk to them about that, why you didn't that. But let's talk about where you do have value and where you do need to capture it. And what was going on here was that you had these very sophisticated marketing people who had been building this algorithm based upon this underlying business method that they were very sophisticated in because they'd been doing it for years. And their boss, the guy who owned the company, said, well, I'll give you equity. The employees own 50% of the company. I'm going to give it to you. I said, well, where's your agreements? He said, we don't have agreements. I said, well, what are you going to do about this? He said, if you walked out the door, he'd be in a world of hurt. And the employees said, high-level employees, director level and above, said, well, he thinks we're replaceable. And I said, well, if you were just doing average high-level marketing stuff, you would be replaceable because you'd go out and pay a headhunter $40K or $50K to place you, and it would take you 3 or 4 months to get up to speed on this particular business. I said, but you're not doing the same old, same old. You're 2 months from launching a major new business model that's going to totally disrupt the industry. If you walked out the door tomorrow, or if you walked out the door within a year, he would have to fold up that business model. So the primary aspect of the business value today in this business model is in the form of the employees. You are not replaceable in this context. And if he does not do something about this now, all this intangible value is going to walk out the door, and he might even have to close up the shop. And so that's – people think it's about patents, it's about trademarks, but when actually you start making this granular – and start understanding where the value lies in the social media space, how much brand value can be articulated that is intangible, that is very, very powerful to people. And when I see the light bulbs go off in people's heads, I just get so thrilled. They go, yeah, you're right. We've got to do something about this now. And then they actually do something that makes a difference to the company.
Has social media simplified or complicated the strategic side of what you do for an entrepreneur?
You know, most business people I work with aren't even thinking about that yet. And I think since they're more in the startup mode, it's more of an execution and not a strategy. So it has complicated, but I don't think they know it yet. And I usually don't want to tackle that because there's so many other fish to fry, as they say.
Sure. Todd and I have been engaged in an activity that's been a lot of fun and has started to make a little bit of money over the last several months, where we're interviewing business authors. And we just sort of stumbled onto this label for what we were doing, and we call it Video Dust Jacket. And we thought, what a really cool name, and people that we run into think it's really cool. And we don't really know what we're doing. I wonder if you could give us just kind of a quick tutorial between copyright, trademark, service mark, and what we know, and I'll tell you off air what we did do with it, but what we should have done with this, like this idea of Video Dust Jacket.
Okay, well, the four main types of intellectual property are patents, trademarks, copyrights, and trade secrets. There's other sidelights of that, but let's talk about those at the forefront. Patents cover inventions. It's what something does or what it is. So if you had a business model, for example, that you're going around and interviewing people, some people would tell you that may be patentable. I don't believe that it is, but they may tell you that. So that would cover the thing that you're doing, that process. Trademarks cover a source identifier. It is a brand. It's in the mind of the consumer, associates a particular product or service with the company. So when you see a stroller that has a particular look, maybe the fabric, the consumer may not know that it's a Graco stroller, but they would be able to sense that source identification and be able to figure that out pretty quickly. Or if it's got a trademark on it, they clearly know that that stroller was associated with that. Copyrights cover original works of authorship in a tangible medium. So a song that's recorded, anything that's written down would be covered by a copyright. Copyrights exist upon the moment of creation. However, if you really want to enforce that, if you want to be able to have enforceable rights in a fairly straightforward manner, you want to record that in the copyright office. It's very inexpensive. You could do it yourself. Don't let anybody charge you to do a copyright. That's not so much with trademarks and patents. They can be a little bit more difficult, although you can do them yourself. But nobody should ever charge you for filing a copyright. And then trade secrets. Trade secrets are the information that has value in your particular industry because you keep it secret. It doesn't not have to be secret in general. Somebody in another industry could know it, but in your particular industry, if it has value and you take steps to keep it secret, then it can be a trade secret and it's enforceable by state statute. So that's the types of intellectual property. Now, in your case, I would imagine the Video Dust Jacket would be a brand or trademark in some context like that. It'd be associated with you when you recorded it or over time. But you do not, in people who get paid to do this don't like it when I tell people this, but you don't have to file a trademark to have protection. You can put a TM behind it. We strongly prefer that you do register it. But if you're in bootstrap mode, you shouldn't be paying people to do this stuff for you.
Jackie, have you seen our blog? Stone has put TM behind every freaking word on the entire blog.
But Stone, bless your heart, as we say in the South, you have to do it correctly.
We do have a lot of TMs floating around.
Oh, we have a lot of TMs. No, I got to tell you, that little description of the four different types was money.
Yeah, very helpful.
We have to edit that little piece out and like...
And copyright it and sell it as our own.
Absolutely. Right.
But you'd be surprised how many really smart people make this mistake. I hear on the radio all the time, you know, like people who should know better. Like, you know, arguably Tom Brokaw should know the difference between a copyright and a trademark and a patent. But these folks at this level have no clue. And so it's just – and people prey on that. People take advantage of the I don't want to say lack of sophistication, but bottom line is they don't teach us stuff in B school. And what I, what my is as an evangelist for IP strategy is to help folks understand where value lies in their business in ways they never could have thought about before because they never learned it. And very often I tell my clients, I said, if you need me in 3 months, I'm not doing my job because this stuff isn't hard. It's not rocket science. It's just a new way of thinking about what you already have.
We introduced you as a recovering patent attorney. It sounds like you've had a pretty interesting career path, going from working for an exceedingly large organization to practicing law to now you serve entrepreneurs. Tell us a little about that journey and how you got from there to here.
Well, I'm not going to start with the punk part because that wasn't the first time I dressed as a punk.
I didn't think it was. you played that role very nicely.
Well, actually, I started my career after graduate school as a hair chemist. I worked for Helen Curtis, and I did hair research and might actually have a graduate degree, have a master's degree in hair. And got bored very, very early because the marketing people would come in and cancel the projects I'd been working on so diligently in R&D. And so I said, you know, I want to have a say in that. So I was like, well, I'm gonna go either be higher up in the organization so I can make those decisions, or I'm going to go to get my MBA, or I'm going to do something else. And my boss, who had a PhD in the particular field that I would have gotten a PhD in, he hated what he was doing. He actually left shortly thereafter. And he says, no, you're not going to do any of that stuff. I said, well, what do I do? And he says, well, you're the only one who can stay up in the meetings with the lawyers. That's why I always send you. So I want you to go to law school. I'm like, oh, gee, being able to stay awake in a meeting, that's that's good. So they should go to law school.
Yes.
Little did I know how marketable it would be. But I went to law school, and actually, you know, if truth be told, I would say I lost my way for a while. I became a very, very highly compensated, high-end lawyer. You know, the law firm I was at was brain surgery, literally was brain surgery. And never met, you know, I dealt with other lawyers, and we did very, very sophisticated stuff. And one day I said, you know, this isn't a lot of fun, and I don't see you doing this stuff for 25 years. And I was given the opportunity to go to a large multinational corporation that's here in town and to work closely with the business people. I was like, that sounds fun. It's consumer products. Yeah, I like to shop. And I went there ostensibly to work with the business people. What I found out that it was basically being in a group of lawyers who pretended to work with the business people because it was a pretty easy gig for lawyers. But that didn't stop me. I worked very closely with the business people. And what I learned, which was quite surprising to me, and in retrospect not, is that we high-end service providers, and this is the very highest level was where I was at, is we assume that people don't get what we're talking about because it's really hard and their eyes glaze over when we talk to them. And what I realized is talking to the business people, they were certainly smart enough to understand what I was talking about. You know, I'm working with people who have got MBAs from Harvard and Chicago and all kinds of really people much better at math than me, and I'm a scientist originally. And what I had to do was be able to communicate this stuff in a way that made what I was doing relevant for their jobs. And that's the biggest problem my patent peers, my IP peers have, is they cannot communicate with business people. And once I learned that, well, you just got to talk about this stuff like it's going shopping or about the product or about what they're trying to sell today or what they're getting their pants beat off because of competitors, why IP, why intangible assets are relevant in that particular space. And they'll invite you to all their lunches because they want to hear about this because they understand what it means. And it had a great time, had a fun time. We did some, you know, some really innovative things. Unfortunately, the organization was not ready for it. I was working for at the core was a commodity company, even though I wanted to be a consumer product company. It's actually a great story. This company got acquired, and I believe the reason why they got acquired is people who acquired them were a commodity company. And so the geniuses that worked in the offices that were so smart they didn't even need to get MBAs. They said, gee, it's really cool. Consumer products, you can get 20% margins. We need to buy a consumer products company. So they did because it was like, well, 20% margins are better than the 2 or 3% margins we're getting in the commodity space. Let's do it. But when they bought the company, they didn't realize that in order to get those margins that look so beautiful in comparison to a commodity company, you have to do stuff like build the brand, like do social media. You have to get people to give them a reason to spend an extra, to do that upgrade. And you know that costs money. That costs money in brand development. That costs money in protecting your proprietary advantage by intellectual property. And not just getting patents for patent's sake, to get patents that have a meaning in the overall business strategy of the company, which, quite honestly, a lot of people who are patent folks don't get why the work that they do should support the business, not support the invention process. And so what I was trying to do was bring these, quite honestly, new and different ways of, and non-controversial in large organizations or different organizations, ways to manage IP, manage intangibles, create and maximize value, but the organization was not ready for it. And so then I said, well, you know what? They downsized, gave me a big check. I'm going to decide what I want to be when I grow up. And I decided that was an IP strategist. Didn't know what that was, but I found out on the internet there was a lot of other people who were thinking like me. And there's at least 250 of us because last year I was named one of the top 250 IP strategists in the world.
There you go.
So if there are 250, I made the short list.
So what's your favorite part about being in more of an entrepreneurial mode and hanging your own shingle out? And what, if anything, do you find a little bit frustrating that you did not have to deal with in the more corporate environment?
I love creating value. And I love that light bulb that goes off when I discuss, you know, stuff that people should really know, but they don't. And when they get it. And I don't mind repeating myself because everybody's story is different. And what I found, further to the conversation about being able to communicate earlier, is that I used to get satisfaction, I guess, in being able to explain really complicated concepts and show how good at case law I was or how great at this particular dealing with the patent office I was in this particular eyelash of a gnat area. Now how I get pure joy is to listen to somebody and to be able to understand what's important to them and communicate why what I do is not just important but critical in their frame of reference. What I do find frustrating, so that's wonderful. I enjoy that so much. And I can, you know, can talk about anybody's business in this context and tell them how to create value, and most people get it. What frustrates me is that there are so few lawyers doing what I'm doing. Mm-hmm. And quite honestly, I think that we're going to be left behind because business people in organizations who get what I do after I'm able to explain it to them. They, as I said, it's not rocket science, and lawyers are going to get the people who know this best are not going to be able to play in the IP strategy space in the future.
We are about out of time, but I have to do this. I asked Bert a serious question, so I need to ask you one. So what poster was on your wall? Was it Johnny Rotten or was it Joey Ramone?
Gang of Four.
Oh, okay. Interesting.
I was more of a progressive chick, but I dated punks.
Okay, good. How can people find you? How do they email you, call you, find you on Twitter?
I have a blog that is takes a lot of time, but it's very fun. It's ipxassetmaximizerblog.com. And I'm also on Twitter at ipstrategist. And my website is thehuttergroup.com.
Okay. You saw us put Bert on the hot seat. So if you would be so kind as to share a mistake that you made in your career and, more importantly, what you learned from it.
Mistake I made in my career was not realizing that if the organization's not ready to change, you ain't going to be able to change it. And, you know, every business book tells you this. I think every mentor will tell you this. But until you've lived it, I don't think you really know it. You can't internalize it. And it's been powerful self-actualization, because I meet with clients or potential clients, and if I, that's the immediate, you know, the temperature I take. You know, if they're not ready, if I don't hear that interest, oh, I got a patent attorney, or I'm already doing something, then it ain't worth my time. I'm, you know, selling against something, existing paradigm. It's not worth my time. But it's made me a much better counselor. It's made me a much better person personally. And it was the best of times, the worst of times. And I don't regret it, but it was hard.
Yeah. Well, thank you for sharing that. It was a pleasure to have you on the show. I didn't realize intellectual property could be fun.
I didn't either.
So, Jackie, thank you so much for being with us. It was great. Stone, another great show, pal.
Oh, I thoroughly enjoyed it. What an enlightening and informative conversation around IP. And I think it has a lot of bearing on the kind of work that you and I try to do in the marketplace and the people that we're trying to serve. Can't wait to meet Sharpie Susan. You know, I mean, Bert, he was okay. You know, you got to start somewhere. But, yeah, I want to meet Sharpie.
Yeah, see, I know Kelly, too.
You know Kelly? Yeah,
so Bert's just a figurehead.
Well, when they're right next door, we got to get them over here, right?
Absolutely. I think this roundtable's got a cool idea.
I like the round. We need more shows during the week, I think.
I agree.
We got to expand, man. We got to grow. Well, until that happens, and until next time, this is Bert Dumars, Jackie Hutter, Stone Payton, Todd Schnick, our producer Lee Cantor, and everyone here at the Radio X family saying we'll see you in the fast lane.